Benjamin Spencer has spent decades in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit. A decade ago, he convinced a judge that he's innocent, and now several of the people who originally sent him to prison agree, yet he's still behind bars. His story punctuates one of the most pressing questions about America's system of justice. When does it care about the truth? This is Radio Atlantic. Hi, I'm Matt Thompson, executive editor of The Atlantic. This week we're bringing you something a bit different. The first installment of a three-part series, reported for The Atlantic by Barbara Bradley Haggerty. If you listen to podcasts, and clearly you do, you've probably heard a story about someone who may have been wrongfully convicted of a heinous crime. And this story certainly fits that description. But in the next few minutes, you're going to hear from a number of individuals who've seen lots and lots, I'm talking hundreds, of potential wrongful convictions up close. And this story still haunts them every day. Because not only is Benjamin Spencer still in prison years after a judge declared him innocent, even if he is innocent, by the rules of our justice system, he may have no way out. Barbara Bradley Haggerty takes it from here.
Passing through the front gates of the maximum security prison, you move from light to shadow, from a fast Texas sky to the windowless visiting room in the H.H. Cofield unit. What would it be like, I wonder, to awaken in this place every morning for 11,000 days? What would it be like, I think, to be the man sitting across from me behind a plexiglass window?
My name is Benjamin John Spencer. My number is 483713. I've been incarcerated since March 26, 1987.
Benjamin Spencer looks professorial in his wire-rimmed glasses. He's 52 now. His hair is flecked with gray, and deep lines are etched across his forehead. He's tall and lanky and still handsome. But the man who once favored snakeskin boots and designer shirts is now consigned to prison whites.
Yeah, it's as sharp as I get now, this white uniform. I don't even care. I mean, I'm just at a point where I'm still hopeful, but at the same time, it's just like I'm stuck in a system.
Spencer was convicted of killing a young white man and dumping his body on a street in the poor neighborhood of West Dallas. 30 years after the crime, people still remember the case, and if my reporting is any guide, many think he's innocent. Even today, Spencer's story haunts people. The foreman of the jury that convicted him.
There's rarely a day that goes by where Ben doesn't cross my mind.
An eyewitness who testified against him.
I want him to get out. That's a long time to be in prison for something you didn't do.
The judge who reconsidered the evidence against him.
My finding was that he was innocent and that he should have a new trial.
Spencer was declared innocent more than a decade ago, but he could still die in prison. This is a story of how that could be, how a tower of damning evidence can topple under scrutiny, and why that might not matter. It's about how the mechanics of the justice system can, possibly, trump truth. It's about this question: will a man found to be innocent spend the rest of his life in prison? On March 22, 1987, Jeffrey Young stopped by the office to catch up on some work. He was 33 years old, soon to become president of a clothing import company. His oldest child, Jay, who was 12 at the time, says his dad often worked on the weekend, but his family came first. Jeffrey Young was tall and slim, with a bushy mustache. He had a taste for practical jokes, a habit of always holding hands with his wife, a passion for immersing himself in his children's lives.
Indian guides, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, campouts. My parents were very involved in the school. They did the carnival. And like today, still to this day, they say it's the best one ever. For me and my brother and sister, when he was there.
Until he wasn't. On that Sunday night, his wife and three children were out of town for spring break, and he wanted to send some faxes to clients in Taiwan.
That's 11:28. I believe 11:27 is this doorway in the middle.
Ben Spencer's current attorney, Cheryl Watley, pulls up to a nondescript gray metal door on Conveyor Lane in the warehouse district of Dallas. Security records show that at 8:21 p.m., Young opened the door to the building. 25 minutes later, he called a friend whose company provided computer services to let him know he would be accessing the computer. That friend, Troy Johnson, said the computers were down. He'd call Young when they were available. Whatley says there were no security cameras to capture what happened next.
We theorize that it was around 9:30 at night when he was getting ready to leave. We think he came to the door. He was getting ready to walk down the steps where he was essentially jumped.
The robber or robbers pushed Young back into the office, grabbed his gold Seiko watch, his wedding ring, and a jambox, a sort of boombox with a portable TV. Around that time, Troy Johnson called back again and again. This would turn out to be a critical detail. Finally, he figured Young had gone home.
During this time, Troy Johnson had been calling and letting the phone ring and ring and ring. We think it was at that time that Mr. Young sustained the fatal blow to his skull, his body then taken out of the office, down those steps, and put into his car, the BMW.
It was a vicious beating. Young's skull was cracked in five places. Then Young and his BMW crossed over the Trinity River to West Dallas.
This is where the body was dumped out.
We retrace the BMW's path two blocks.
The BMW pulls into the alley. We don't know quite how far it pulls in, but it stops here.
Eventually, three people would tell police that they saw two men jump out of the car. As for Jeffrey Young, he was pronounced dead at 3:05 a.m. The man who loomed larger than life for his wife and preteen children, that man disappeared from their lives in an instant. The sheer randomness of the crime rattled white communities in Dallas. One minute a young businessman is sending a fax to Taiwan, the next he's beaten and left to die on an unfamiliar street. In this crime, two Dallases collided. There was West Dallas, a poor, largely black neighborhood, suffering through the peak of the crack epidemic. And then there was the 1980s soap opera Dallas. A wealthy, glitzy Dallas, a city bursting with promise and a famous football team. This was the Dallas of H. Ross Perot, a self-made billionaire and entrepreneur. Perot served on city commissions. He contributed generously to the Dallas Police Association. And eventually, he would run not once, but twice for president.
Good afternoon. The volunteers in all 50 states have asked me to run as a candidate for president of the United States.
I mean, despite his little squeaky voice and his little crew-cut haircut, he was a force in Dallas, and a force to be reckoned with.
Veteran journalist Bob Ray Sanders. Perot loomed large not only in the politics of the city and the nation, but also in Jeffrey Young's story. You see, Perot was close to the victim's father, Harry Young. Young served as one of the top executives at Perot's company, EDS. In fact, Harry Young was traveling for work when his son was killed, and Perot sent his private plane to bring him back to Dallas. Beyond that, Perot's company offered a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and indictment of Jeffrey Young's killer. Bob Ray Sanders says that reward sent a message to the Dallas Police Department, find Jeffrey Young's killer fast.
So just his name associated with the case would say it had to be done and should be done quickly.
But that was easier said than done, because Jeffrey Young's body was found in the other Dallas, West Dallas. Police would have to build a case in a neighborhood where they were strangers and viewed with mistrust. Michael Phillips wrote a history of Dallas called White Metropolis. He says the 1980s marked a low point in relations between police and residents of West Dallas. When a crime occurred, he says, any minority would do.
And the attitude was sort of like that character in the movie Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. The idea was that if we arrest black and brown people, they have to be guilty of something. So even if they're not guilty of this specific crime, there's some other terrible deed they've committed. So there's no loss if we toss them in jail. And this creates a sense of total distrust between the black community and the white community and white law enforcement.
Law enforcement, in this case, was led by Detective Jesus, or Jesse Braceno. He recalls arriving early Monday morning and canvassing the neighborhood.
some people wouldn't, like I said, give us the time of day. And then some others would, and then you would have to take that with a tongue in cheek, whether you believed him or not.
He says Monday turned up no viable leads, in his judgment anyway. Nothing on Tuesday either. Then on Wednesday, the case broke wide open. 42-year-old Gladys Oliver identified the perpetrators. Detective Briseno found her particularly credible.
She was an older person, not a young kid. And I figured that she was trustworthy. I didn't think that she had anything to lie or get out of it at that point.
At first, Oliver told police that she hadn't seen anything. But after she discovered there was a reward for information leading to the arrest of the assailants, she came forward. The state built its case around Gladys Oliver, so here are a few details about her. Oliver was a well-known figure in the intimate neighborhood of West Dallas. She sold candy and barbecue chicken sandwiches on the weekends to earn some cash. She was nearly crippled from polio, hadn't worked in 4 years, and survived on disability checks. And she was nosy. That's her word. She passed the time keeping an eye on the neighbors. Oliver's house overlooked the alley where Jeffrey Young's BMW was abandoned. She told police that on that night she saw two of her neighbors, Benjamin Spencer and Robert Mitchell, get out of the car and rush away. Then she pointed the detectives to two other possible eyewitnesses. Two young men told police they happened to be looking at the alley at the same time and saw the same thing as Oliver from different vantage points and distances. With that testimony in place, the case was a slam dunk. Decades after the crime, Faith Johnson, the current district attorney and a former judge, a conservative Republican who relishes a good case, says this one was a prosecutor's dream.
You had three eyewitnesses. And these were not eyewitnesses who were strangers, you know, strangers who all of a sudden had to pick somebody out of a lineup. But these people knew Spencer. And that's what's so exciting about this case. We just don't get that every day in a trial. We don't.
We don't know the details of Spencer's first trial from October 1987. The transcript was inexplicably lost. We do know that the three eyewitnesses identified Spencer and that Gladys Oliver turned in a killer performance. We do know that a jailhouse informant swore that Spencer told him that he had killed Jeffrey Young. We do know that Spencer's attorney relied almost exclusively on an alibi witness. 4 days later, the jury found Spencer guilty of murder and sentenced him to 35 years in prison. Frank Jackson, Spencer's attorney in the first trial, was disappointed, but not surprised.
It's hard to overcome a dead white guy who's killed by two black men in a black area of Dallas where you dump his body out on the street, and you know, it's just hard to overcome that kind of emotional case.
But there was one flaw with the state's star witness, Gladys Oliver. She lied on the stand. Spencer's attorney discovered that Oliver had received $580 in exchange for information she gave to Crime Stoppers. It wasn't much, but enough to merit a new trial. In March of 1988, right before the second trial, prosecutors approached Spencer's attorney, Frank Jackson, with a deal. 20 years in prison, and Spencer would be eligible for parole in less than five.
If it were me, knowing the parole law at that time, I would have probably taken it and run with it.
Jackson told Spencer it was a good deal. Remember, Spencer had already been convicted once, but Spencer thought he could clear his name.
I said, I didn't do anything. He was saying, well, you know, if you take it to trial, they're going to try to give you a life sentence. They're likely to get it. And so I'm like, well, I don't care what they're likely to get. I said, I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do.
The prosecutor left the district attorney's office after the first trial. He declined to talk with me. His replacement, Andy Beach, was given less than 6 months to prepare for the retrial. But he had an ace in the hole, Gladys Oliver.
There's no question that Gladys Oliver's testimony convicted Ben Spencer.
Oliver rolled into the courtroom in a wheelchair. She sat eye level with the jury, a shawl covering her lap. She gave her account in vivid, succinct detail. She was awakened at 10:30 p.m. by the dogs barking next door. She looked out her bedroom window and saw Benjamin Spencer climb out of the passenger seat. She insisted that even though it was a moonless night, she could see his face because of a nearby streetlight and the light from her neighbor's porch. Oliver said she then put on a dress, peered out the front door, and spotted Spencer walking up her driveway. Oliver was feisty, witty. She didn't lie on the stand this time. When Spencer's attorney asked if she wanted to collect the reward money, she said, "Hell, if they want to give me some, it's fine with me." Beach says she owned that courtroom.
In the 25 years I tried criminal cases, she was one of the top three or four eyewitnesses of all time. Just her physical presence and her ability to clearly answer questions and to stand up to cross-examination, it carried the day for us, there's no question.
The jury loved her. She reminded the foreman, William Allen Ledbetter, of his grandmother, the neighborhood busybody.
I mean, I still remember saying, I peeps out my window. And I mean, it just sounded so much like my grandmother. And just keeping an eye on the neighbors, and particularly the neighbors who my grandmother thought were up to no good at all times.
Now, the prosecution had a problem. No physical evidence connected Spencer to the assault of Jeffrey Young. The police never found a murder weapon or any stolen property. The fingerprints lifted from Jeffrey Young's car and office did not match those of Spencer or Mitchell. Enter a jailhouse informant, Danny Edwards. Edwards had shared a cell with Spencer right after he was arrested. He told the jury that Spencer admitted to killing Young. He added that Spencer's only regret was that he didn't finish the job at the office. He told the jury, Spencer said, quote, "I should have killed the bitch right then and there." Cheryl Watley, Spencer's current attorney, says Danny Edwards' testimony played a crucial role.
The only story, the only testimony that you have about Ben having contact with Jeffrey Young comes from the mouth of Danny Edwards.
On the stand, Edwards' flamboyant testimony often conflicted with the facts and even the prosecution's theory. Edwards said Spencer grabbed the victim by the tie and choked him, but Young was wearing jogging clothes, no tie. Edwards claimed that Spencer's accomplice was a fellow named Van Mitchell Spencer. The prosecution said it was Robert Mitchell. Most memorably, Edwards stated that Spencer was not worried about police finding his fingerprints at the office or in the car because he had rubbed his fingers on the pavement and scoured off his prints. Spencer's fingerprints were intact. District Attorney Faith Johnson says these discrepancies did not matter.
We can talk all day long about the jailhouse snitch. We can just say, so what? He got confused, or he missed it, or what have you. But we still got our credible witnesses. And that's what we're basing our case on.
For its part, the defense case was built almost entirely around one alibi witness. And here's an irony. The witness testified to the most important hours of Benjamin Spencer's life, the hours when Jeffrey Young was murdered. But these hours were also the most shameful of his life. At 22, Spencer was working the overnight shift, unloading trucks. He had just gotten married.
Deborah and I, we were expecting our first child. I think she was like 7 months pregnant when I got arrested. So we were just, you know, I was trying to get myself together, both financially and mentally and physically, you know, so we can move on with our lives.
Were you happy then?
Yes and no. For some reason, Deborah and I, we was like, we would have good days, we would have bad days. Sometimes we would have more bad days than good days.
The Sunday of Jeffrey Young's murder was a bad day. The couple argued. Deborah went to bed early. Spencer went to see another woman. Christy Williams lived across the street. She was an 18-year-old high school senior, a track star headed to college on a scholarship, an acquaintance, a temptation. Williams testified that they hung out in her house from around 7:30 p.m. to 9:30 or 10 when her younger brothers came home from playing street football. She and Spencer left then and drove to the park, where they remained past midnight. I asked Williams if Spencer had slipped away for an hour and come back. In other words, could he have robbed and killed Jeffrey Young?
Not in the time frame that they're saying, because I know for a fact that we were together at the time that they were saying that it happened. So I'm like, no, it couldn't have happened.
In the absence of physical evidence, the jury had to decide which witnesses to believe and which to discount. In other words, who had a more credible story, the middle-aged busybody, Gladys Oliver, or the teenage track star, Christy Williams? They chose Oliver. The jury convicted Spencer of aggravated robbery and sentenced him to life in prison. A few days later, in a separate trial that Gladys Oliver also dominated, Robert Mitchell was found guilty as well. The night of the verdict, Spencer returned to the county jail. It was late.
I was the only one on the floor at the time. I was the only one in the holdover. And it's cold. And to be honest, I really want to die. I thought about committing suicide while I was in the holdover. And I'd start thinking about, I have my faith, I have my belief, and I was like, well, if I die, if I kill myself, I can't go to heaven, you know? And so that was the only hope I had, was I didn't want to go to hell.
Surely, he thought, the biblical promise will prevail. The truth will set you free. The 12 men and women on the jury had heard a coherent story and reached a rational verdict. But there was another story to be told.
In a moment, Barbara will tell us that story and how Benjamin Spencer helped uncover it while he was behind bars. The story that you're listening to began as a feature in the print edition of The Atlantic. Although in this episode and subsequent episodes, you'll be hearing several details that have never before been reported. If you're not a subscriber to our print magazine, you're missing out. And Radio Atlantic listeners get a special 15% discount on subscriptions. Just go to theatlantic.com/radiosubscribe.
Soon after the trial, Benjamin Spencer moved into the Cofield Maximum Security Prison south of Dallas. He exchanged his designer shirts and snakeskin boots for prison whites and sneakers. Then he settled into the chrysalis years. From outside the prison walls, his case seemed to stagnate, but from within, Spencer was working, methodically gathering evidence to prove his innocence. First, he needed help on the outside.
At that time, I was writing any and everybody I could think of that I thought might be able to help me. Of course, the only ones who stayed consistent in responding was Centurion Ministries.
Centurion Ministries predated the Innocence Project, and at that time, it was the only national group that reinvestigated cases of prisoners who claimed to be innocent. Jim McCluskey, the founder of Centurion Ministries, shows me a wall of photos of inmates he has helped free, images of lives lost, then found.
Danny Brown, Toledo, Ohio, 19 years. Matt Connor, Philadelphia, 11 years. This is David Milgaard, a Canadian. We free two Canadians. This is his mother, Joyce.
In each, the man or woman is grinning or crying, standing on the courthouse steps after years of wrongful incarceration. McCluskey smiles as he ticks off the names of people who were exonerated because of Centurion Ministries. 61 of them so far.
This is Curry Max Cook, 22 years on Texas death row. This is Mark Shan out of Springfield, Massachusetts, 27 years. This is literally when he took his first step into freedom.
He's jumped on you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just first thing he did. It was great. Yeah.
McCluskey received Benjamin Spencer's first letter in January 1990, just a few years after he founded Centurion Ministries. The organization began as a spiritual calling for McCluskey. In 1979, after years as a naval officer in the Vietnam War and later in business, McCluskey sensed an existential void.
I felt I was living a superficial, selfish, self-centered life.
McCluskey entered Princeton Theological Seminary when he was 37. As part of his training, he served as a volunteer chaplain at Trenton State Prison. There, he met a former heroin addict who had been convicted of murder and sentenced to life. Every time they talked, the inmate insisted that he had been wrongly convicted. McCluskey found that hard to believe.
I couldn't imagine that the police or the prosecutors would ever bring to the bar of justice anything but credible and compelling evidence of guilt. Or that police would lie or that prosecutors would hide evidence of innocence. That was foreign to me, alien concept.
McCluskey agreed to read through the inmates' trial transcripts over Thanksgiving break, and he came to believe he was innocent.
He said, "What are you going to do? Do you believe I'm innocent?" I said, "Well," his nickname was Chiefy. I said, "Yeah, I guess I'm kind of there now." He said, "Well, what are you going to do to help me?" I said, "Chiefy, what can I do? I don't know anything about the criminal justice system. I've been a businessman, for God's sake." He said, "You can't just go back to the seminary in your safe little dormitory room and pray for me. That's not going to get me out." He said, "God works through human beings, and you're the only human being I have."
McCluskey deferred seminary classes for a year and reinvestigated the case. He discovered that an eyewitness had lied, and the state knew that its star witness, a jailhouse informant, had perjured himself. McCluskey recruited a pro bono lawyer, and soon after that, Chiefy walked out of prison, exonerated. McCluskey realized his call was not to the pulpit, but to freeing the wrongly convicted. With almost no money, he launched Centurion Ministries out of his bedroom in Princeton, one he occupied rent-free in exchange for running errands for his elderly landlady.
And I named it Centurion after the centurion at the foot of the cross in the Gospel of Luke, who looked up at the crucified Christ and said, "Surely this one was innocent." That's where the name comes from.
For the first few years, McCluskey worked with a handful of volunteers in relative obscurity. Then, in 1986, Centurion won freedom for a man who had been convicted of rape and kidnapping. The New York Times covered the story. 60 Minutes followed with a profile of McCluskey. Letters began to pour into his landlady's house.
So here's this woman, 85 years old. Letters are coming in from convicted murderers and rapists all over the country. And she said, "Jim, who are these people? Are they going to come and get us?" Oh, the poor lady. You know, Texas State Prison. Oh, San Quentin Prison. They would pour in to her home at 72 Library Place.
So when Spencer sent his first letter, Centurion was receiving more than 1,000 requests a year. They sent back a boilerplate response, informing Spencer that they were swamped. But they invited him to write back.
And so I was like, "Man, they'll probably never get around to my case." But the people, the volunteers who would write back to me, you know, it was kind of a glimmer of hope. Well, maybe.
It was a long shot. The group could handle only a handful of investigations at a time. McCluskey says that's because most of Centurion's cases do not involve untested DNA evidence, that forensic magic bullet that can exclude and exonerate one person and point decisively to another perpetrator.
This is a non-DNA case, and I knew from the get-go that there was a lot of work to be done.
If they accepted Spencer as a client, Centurion investigators would have to start from scratch, knocking on doors, tracking down new witnesses and old ones, trying to find exculpatory forensic evidence, hiring lawyers, and asking a judge to look at the new evidence. All this took time and money, usually more than $100,000 per case. So, to concentrate on the most deserving and winnable cases, McCluskey had developed a rigorous screening process.
First of all, we start corresponding with the inmate. And we put the inmate to work, answering a lot of questions.
Spencer's 14-page autobiography, penned in small, precise handwriting, details a modest but stable childhood revolving around family and the Church of Christ. His mother cleaned houses and ran the youth ministry at their church. His father worked on the assembly line at General Motors and preached when the pastor was away. Spencer thought he'd follow in his footsteps.
I had a thing about truck driving. I like big rigs, and I always thought I might become a truck driver one day and even also become a minister. I didn't make it to any one of those.
Spencer doesn't like to talk about ministry. It's a cliche. All prisoners want to be preachers, right? But I've seen the notebooks filled with Bible class homework. His sister told me that as a child, he'd preside over the funeral of pets, preaching a eulogy for their late dog or cat and serving juice and crackers as communion. In the middle of 11th grade, Spencer's parents divorced and his mother and four siblings moved from the Oak Cliff neighborhood to West Dallas, which he said had a bad reputation. I was pretty much a loner, Spencer wrote me in one of a half dozen long letters he sent me over the summer. He graduated from high school. He didn't join a gang, didn't use drugs. His life revolved around cars. In fact, cars figured in Spencer's only three brushes with the law, twice for driving with a suspended sentence, and once for joyriding in a car that his best friend stole. On his 18th birthday, Spencer's mother gave him the keys to a 1973 Ford Gran Torino. He fell instantly in love. As I'm sitting here typing this letter, he wrote, I have my headphones on and I'm listening to this song that became my theme song way back then.
You know very well what you are. You're my sugar thing, my chocolate star.
Juicy Fruit by M. Toomey, he wrote. Yeah, those were the days.
But you're the only love that gives me good and plenty.
I envisioned Spencer in his cell, humming to the rhythm, singing a few words, transported briefly to those days of freedom. As a young man, Spencer never settled into a career, but moved through a series of jobs, washing cars, light maintenance work, serving at fast food restaurants. Wendy's is one of the best jobs I ever had, he wrote me. Girls flirted with him. He was polite and handsome, always meticulously dressed with a fresh haircut every Friday. But in the back of his mind, he always remembered his mother's warning.
I think one of the things my mother used to always tell us, well, you know, as boys, well, if you mess with a girl and you get her pregnant, you're gonna take care of the, you're gonna get a job and you're gonna take care of this child. You know, you're not just gonna be running around saying you're a daddy, you know.
And so when Spencer's first serious girlfriend, Deborah Childs, became pregnant, he married her. Before his son was born, though, Spencer had been arrested for murder. During that first decade inside prison, Spencer's world moved glacially. He cut hair as a prison barber and worked as a clerk in the education department. Meanwhile, the world outside sped by the milestones. His wife gave birth to their baby boy, Benjamin John Spencer. She was promoted and moved away from West Dallas. Whenever she could, Deborah brought BJ down to the prison. The baby first saw his father through a plexiglass window. Eventually, they were permitted contact visits.
You know, I stand them on the table, and they play and talk and carry on like that, but it's still totally ridiculous to me. Room full of people talking, you can't hardly hear each other, and you know, you got a baby sitting here in a room full of just everybody and germs, and it was horrible.
After a few years, Spencer urged her to file for divorce.
Well, I mean, I'm in here, she's out there. Just because my life had been taken from me, I feel like she didn't deserve what she was going through. In fact, I wasn't, although I wasn't all the way unfaithful, I wasn't very faithful. And so I just felt that she deserved to be happy. And I knew that being in a relationship with a husband that wasn't present, she couldn't be too happy like that. I mean, that just, to me, that wasn't a life for anybody.
Eventually, Deborah did file for divorce. She kept the Spencer name. For 10 years, from 1990 to 2000, Spencer lived for mail delivery, eager for the next letter from Centurion Ministries. He was in limbo, not yet a client.
Whether they took my case or not, this was my lifeline. And so I wanted them to know everything I knew. And what I didn't know, I wanted them to try to find out.
He sent them his trial record, annotated in his microscopic handwriting, pointing out errors or inconsistencies in testimony. He identified people who could corroborate his alibi, who were never called by the defense or even tracked down. He found evidence that another man had committed the crime and located two men who insisted they had given statements to that effect to the police. From inside the prison walls, Benjamin Spencer pieced together a story that had never been told. In essence, he drafted a blueprint for Centurion's investigation. Finally, in 2000, McCluskey visited him in prison to tell him they were taking the case.
And I was really impressed with him, and I walked away thinking, we can't leave this man behind.